When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Masters of the Air, episodes 1 and 2 are over, but we are just getting started here on post-show recaps. My name is Ariel, and I am joined, of course, by my co-pilot, my map reader, who hopefully can keep his lunch in. It's Rich. What's up, Rich?
How are you, Ariel? I can keep my lunch down. I'm pretty good on a plane. I think that the official title is The Navigator, and The Flight of the Navigator was one of my favorite childhood movies. I wore out the VHS tape.
Wow.
So I will take The Flight of the Navigator with you anytime, Ariel.
I love this. You're always here to correct me about the names and all the stuff. I appreciate that. Yeah, Masters of the Air, we finally are here covering the show proper. If you're just discovering us, we did a whole deep dive into Band of Brothers and The Pacific, which were like precursors to the series, same executive production teams, and obviously about the same war. Band of Brothers being about the Army paratroopers, and then the Marines and the Pacific, and now we are here at the Air Force, and about 10 years-ish, a little bit more between each project. I think we were both on the same page, Rich, about like not quite sure what to expect, but you know, they released these two episodes in one neat package. How were you feeling about it afterwards?
Yeah, we were just talking a little bit in our pre-production meeting, Ariel, and I was saying I went the full like Kevin Mahadeo experience here for Masters of Air. I did not watch a single trailer. I was very unaware of the specificity of the story we were coming into. I really wanted to come in cold and fresh because there's so many expectations attached to this production team. They got the writer back from Band of Brothers and John Orloff. They're adapting another literary work.
A book? They love to adapt a book in this universe. I thought of you.
I think it's the move, though, right? Because again, I mean, we talked about it so much that like it's this firsthand experience, and the way that that translates from into the telling in the book, and then from the book to this visually kind of stunning array. I mean, this is a $300 million production. They have spared no expense, Ariel. Mm-hmm. So my expectations, like, I kind of had none. They were sort of subdued. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect to be as blown away as Band of Brothers. I hoped I would appreciate it as much as The Pacific. I think it starts really strong. I think it's got some of the same challenges as The Pacific. Like, I think that Band of Brothers formula of one company of men that are just getting to know each other in boot camp, it really roots us in so well with these characters. And we're not quite in like Medeus Reyes here with these guys. Like, we drop in, but they're all already soldiers. They're already like ranked. They're majors in the Army Air Force. I think this is like the beginning of what the Air Force will become. But I think it really works. Ariel, like, it captured the weight. And when I realized that we're tracking bomber crews and not fighter pilots, which again, like, I'm sure a lot of people do this, but I stayed cold on it. It's great because it makes for these tiny ensembles at every plane, right?
Yeah,
every one of those planes has such drama going on inside of it. And I think that I think it worked more than it didn't for me. I came away really pleased and excited for episode 3.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I wasn't sure again what to expect, and I was a little bit specifically, I was, I think, most scared about, you know, these shots in the air and what looked to be in the very few trailers that I did see when they would like pop up in, you know, whatever ad space, of like the CGI nature of some of these shots. And I was like, oh god, this can go really bad very quickly. But to your point, there's a lot of money in it, so obviously they want it to look good, and we know from the previous series that these creators always want to do right by the story and by the product and by these characters. It's really interesting to me, this other aspect of like the quote unquote non-famous people that they cast in Band of Brothers and The Pacific versus the fairly famous cast here, like going into it. And I think there's something to be said about, you know, the context of the state of TV that those series were made in and like the higher stakes now that exist, you know, in this competition in the streaming era of needing to really grab the attention of the viewers and attract viewers. And in that sense, like needing these like big names in the cast.
I think you're spot on, Ariel. It's really interesting because there have been so many kind of think piece articles around Band of Brothers and revisiting it while Masters of Air is about to premiere here or was about to premiere. And I think that going back, you know, Band of Brothers is like the bleeding edge of prestige TV in a lot of ways, right? It's right there with The Sopranos, The Wire, these shows that we would really look back on as beginning to herald in the heights of this really mature and professional long form storytelling on television that we hadn't necessarily seen before. And I think that, you know, we talk about it all the time around these parts, but the TV landscape is so fragmented and siloed now. There have been such an incredible abundance of TV shows over the past few years that I'm sure you've had a similar experience. I'm talking about some of these shows like Foundation Season 2 or From is on MGM Plus, you know, and it's like, oh, then you want to tell your friend and like, do you have Apple TV? Do you have MGM Plus? Do you have Amazon Prime? Do you know that you can watch videos on Amazon Prime? You know,
there's like a whole prefacing to that conversation that you need to kind of establish.
It's hard. Yeah. And HBO is one of these 40-year-old ubiquitous brands, right? It's really like in the home of people that are not kind of millennial Gen Z cord cutters, right? Like it pulls bigger audiences. They market the shows better. So Apple has done some incredible productions. And I think to your point of the CGI, there were a few shots that I was like, ooh, right? I think that, you know, the whole narrative of like the British RAF guys giving the American shit about you fly these bombing runs during the day. And I could feel a little bit of that, like the meta narrative of the show of like, yeah, it's a lot harder to do the good CGI in the day, right?
When that's true, right? Absolutely.
B-52s and like flak and darkness,
you know? Right.
But nonetheless, I think you're right. Like the star power of like an Austin Butler, Barry Keoghan. I know like Callum is also notable. He's not somebody that stands out as much to me, but like you need something to pull the audience in. It's something with the Wheel of Time that we felt a lot, where the Wheel of Time season 2 premiered during the Screen Actors Guild strike, and so their big stars, their Rosamund Pikes, their Daniel Hennies couldn't promote Ariel. The second the strike ended, these folks went out and did one interview and you could see the numbers spike again on Amazon. All of a sudden, like the viewership exploded. And I think it really does matter, these folks like making the rounds, being on the late night shows, doing the interviews to like bring an audience in, you know?
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah, we have the aforementioned Austin Butler who plays, and this is like, we talked about this on the Pacific especially, but like sometimes the difficulty, and it's very early on, it's only been two episodes, but like the difficulty in tracking all of the names. And here we have the extra wrinkle of Austin Butler playing Buck and then Callum Turner playing Bucky.
I kind of love it. And it's one of these things that you know they didn't write because they're real guys, right? And but like it's wild to me that these two guys are Buck and Bucky. And I love that they make it a story point, like immediately. To seconds into the first episode, we're gonna like address the Buck and Bucky situation, you know? And even their last names, Ariel, are like so close to one another of these two guys.
Yeah, it's Egan and Clevin. It's just like if you're saying it fast enough, they do sound alike. It's very funny. And I like the idea. For me in my head, it actually makes it easier in a way because it's one name that you have to remember across two people, and then like Austin Butler, you know, and this isn't, I don't, no shade when I say this, but like Austin Butler is the bigger name, so he's the Buck, right? And then Callum Turner is a little bit less, so he's the Bucky. Like it makes sense to me. And obviously anytime anyone said Bucky, I couldn't help but think of Captain America.
How can you not? It just pulls so hard. You come into the scene and Austin Butler has that Steve Evans vibe. He's the blonde, the jawline, Ariel. Yeah. Like, oh my God.
This is definitely post the super soldier serum for sure. For Buck.
Yes. Yes. These two, man, it just, I totally felt those same vibes and it pulled me out for a moment where I was like, gosh, like, what are we doing here? And then I had to reset myself a little bit of like, no, but this is a real story. These are real men, you know? And again, incredible. Like they're already majors in the Army Air Force and like ranked kind of soldiers with a little bit. And I like that it is just one name that they share. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty funny coincidence at the end.
Yeah, there's something to your point about them being majors already. Like there's something in my mind, at least I couldn't help but, you know, create like one-to-one comparisons of like, okay, so these are kind of the Winters and the
Nixon,
Ray Nix of Band of Brothers. Like they're the ones in charge and they're really good friends. We have also the aforementioned Barry Keoghan, who is riding his Saltburn wave right now. So this premieres at a good time for him.
He's amazing, man. I mean, to see him coming from Dunkirk too, you know, Ariel, I'm like one of these diehard Nolan bros. I love Dunkirk. And to see him go from that role, playing a young British boy, like so overwhelmed by it, to like the accent, Ariel. Oh my God. Barry Keoghan is bringing it, man. They finally gave this kid something to chew on. He's really wild in Saltburn with my beloved Rosamund Pike from The Wheel of Time. But I love seeing Barry Keoghan in this project. This kid is like so fun. Where Austin Butler is somebody that like you're the movie man and you're a little more tapped into his recent works, but straight up, I'm going to indict myself because one of my favorite filthy, guilty pleasures of like garbage TV that I love is the Shannara Chronicles starring Austin Butler. And he plays this very goofy kid that I'm like, this is going to be a tough transition for me, man, to accept him. But I think to your point of like the Nixon and the Winters, Buck Cleven, Butler's character, he really is a Dick Winters. He doesn't drink. Yeah. He doesn't smoke. You know, I mean, you can almost hear Garnier making fun of him in the back of a truck. Like,
for sure.
There's such mirrored energy between Buck and Bucky. And I can already feel that this is going to be like a powerful emotional center to our story, you know.
I agree. And another pair, just while we're doing a little bit of overall casting, at least these are the few characters. There's obviously a lot more characters that we meet, but these are the few characters that, one, I emotionally connected with, and two, I think the show is priming us to like keep an eye on as the episodes go on. We meet Crosby, who is...
Bing.
Crosby's a guy who maybe shouldn't be eating so much. I don't know. Before he gets on the plane, like maybe eat less. Maybe it's like a liquid diet. I'm not sure. But he's played by Anthony Boyle. Really funny. I love his relationship with Bubbles, who is played by Louis Greatorex. Apologies for the mispronunciation. He's British. So I was like, Greta Rowe? No, he's not Cajun. Like, that's not how you say it. But I like that we have like some people that we can latch on to because of different contexts. So it's, so far it's working for me.
I think, so the Crosby character is delightful. I think his narration throughout is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. There's such like chaotic energy to the action. It's such a kind of like frenetic pace when we're up in the air in these planes. I think having him ground us out with this kind of narration and like seed us a little bit in what's going on, help us to understand the crews, the formations. There's something really powerful to it. And the other thing is something that, you know, I talked about a lot, this whole idea of the American mythology, right? And the stories that we tell about these men that went and fought the Great War, Ariel. And it's easy to like really lionize them and to build them up. And I think that even Band of Brothers does it. We see a lot of their character flaws and the rough edges of these guys. But I think to get a character like Crosby, he just connects to a modern audience in a way that like Buck does not. Like as we're looking at Buck and Bucky, these are 20-something-year-old men that are flying these like many ton hulking flying fortresses through the air. We watched that landing in Norway in the beginning, and you realize the kind of pressure that these guys are under have to do this kind of shit. And to see a Harry Crosby that cracks under that pressure, this guy, like, he can't really handle it, right? The air sickness, the, like, we've never been on planes before. Most of us have never left our hometowns. Like, mm-hmm. he captures so much of that. And I think really relates to a modern audience in a way of, like, it feels so far away, I think, in certain ways, to imagine being a 20-year-old kid that's going to, like, enlist to go do this, right? Yeah. That he really grounded me out, and it was a really great performance. I love Crosby. Great.
Yeah, Crosby, he at first I was like, oh God, Crosby, get it together. And, like, I wasn't sure how I felt about him. And then by the end of the second episode, I'm like, I'm all in on Crosby. He's one of my guys to watch.
And they quietly did such an excellent job managing the vomit, like, amidst the horror show that was happening in that plane. It was really impressive to me that Crosby's vomit was, like, the thing that consistently made me most uncomfortable. Ariel, yes. Like, it was like wallpaper. It was spread on
I have to say, those paper bags, like, I assume that they're lined. I can only assume that they're lined, because otherwise, what's the point? But, like, I was like, those are paper bags. Like, this cannot end. Like, from the very first moment we see it, I'm like, this is not going to end well. Like, there are too many bags. He's losing track of
them. I know. I'm like, where are you putting that bag? Don't put that bag there. Then he slams it down. But I'm with you. We shared a thought. I definitely was like, those bags are waxed. Wax paper. That's a line bag. There's no chance. They're not giving these kids paper bags. I mean, I couldn't get a peanut butter jelly sandwich to second grade in a paper bag.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, Kroz. You know, I know it's not everyone's thing to be looking at actual, I will use a different word to trigger people less, regurgitation from a human, but you know, I think to your point, they do a good job balancing the uncomfortable nature of the situation and playing it for laughs in a way.
Yeah, I'm being silly about it. And I think they do a good job bringing some levity into the environment that is, like, really heavy, you know, but there is a realness to it. There's a granularity to it of, like, oh no, let's remember these guys are 25,000 feet in the air. It's sub-zero. They're getting, like, frostbite from sitting on the planes. The guy touches the gun. His fingers are melting off, like, the vomit. This is like a pressure cooker to the extreme. I think we often think of, like, submarines as, like, the ultimate kind of, like, nightmare fuel kind of place to be trapped in, right? But there's a similarity to that. And just to touch on it again, I talked so much about my family's experience with the war, Ariel. My uncle, who was a pilot, was very much like a father to me. The guy's name was Harry. And so I really, like, root in with Crosby a lot. Harry Crosby, like, he's looking right at me through the screen, you know?
Mm-hmm. You feel it. Mm-hmm. So let's get into some episode specific details. We're not going to go super beat by beat, but we'll hit all the big notes in the episode. Certainly.
Hopefully. Can I just drop down one more casting beat that caught me was Isabella May. Like, again, we talk about how, like, God, by the sheer nature of the story we're telling, these are going to be, like, male dominated casts
for sure.
Like, shows about men in such a big way. But I think opening with Buck and Bucky with their girlfriends. Isabel May is an actress who was on 1883 in the, like, Taylor Sheridan cinematic universe.
Right.
And she really struck me as, like, a very powerful young performer. And so she was, like, Buck's girl in the beginning kind of scene there. And I don't know what kind of, like, relevance she will have as we drive forward into the narrative, but it struck me as, like, kind of big casting for a very small part. She's not, like, a huge star, but she's somebody that was, like, immediately recognizable and has some name recognition for me. And I'm curious the ways that they will incorporate, like, the girls back home, the women's side of this war as we move forward through this story. I just wanted to note that before we
No, I appreciate that. And it makes sense, certainly, like, you know, in the Pacific, they did that a little bit more. Like, you could feel them, you know, and to be clear, I don't mean to imply that it all felt like shoehorned in or some kind of, you know, tacked on thing, but they definitely went out of their way to try to incorporate more female perspectives. And I imagine that this, to your point, will be even more of that. And that's definitely a known quantity in that actress. So I think that's probably a good call.
Yeah, I mean, again, it just speaks to the decades, right? And the ways that it changes in terms of, like, how we're casting, how we're writing, the way we're adapting this stuff, you know? I'm curious to see. It's just a note for me going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I will just say off the bat, of course, you know, a friendly spoiler warning for episodes 1 and 2, just in case you didn't know what we were going to talk about on the podcast. So episode one, we pretty much, you know, we start on a very somewhat muted scene with the girlfriends, as you said, but we very quickly get in the air, and we have like the harrowing images, shots of these men being fired at and people getting hurt, literally shot. And there's no medic in the air. Like, we're so used to, it struck me, we're so used to in the first two series, like them calling out for the medic right away when someone gets hurt. And that's not an option here. You have to land the plane first. Well, first get out of enemy fire, then land the plane, then try to get this person saved in all this time. And it's like, it just feels that much more, to your point about the pressure cooker, it feels that much more of like a really severe situation.
There's just everything working against you, Ariel. You know, I feel like it was so powerful so immediately. It's a good job just to set us in these guys' personality. We get the vibe of Bucky as like fun-loving, energetic, enthusiastic. They're all such hotshots, right? They're like chomping at the bit. One of us has got to go see combat, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got that same like kind of Sledge energy from the Pacific of like the naivety of these men, you know? They just couldn't possibly know what they were walking into. And so again, like we're tracking B-17. This is like the 100th bomb group. These are bomber planes. They're not like the B-52s that you have the paratroopers jumping out of and banned. And they're not fighter pilots. They're not like your Mustangs that get all like the flair and the class. And it really hit me the way that we assemble the crew. You have 10 guys in each of these planes, like every one of those planes blowing up in the air. That's many, many men. Those are many lives just snuffed out. And the way you're getting the reactions to it as it, the weight of reality crashes into these guys. Not to mention, Ariel, there's just like, there's so much working against them. As we live in like a modern culture in the 21st century, we take stuff like power steering so for granted, you know, like hydraulic assisted mechanics in your car. Like these are very simple mechanisms. You know, I'm a guy that's driven a lot of like heavy equipment. I was on like bobcats and garbage plants when I was a little kid, and forklifts and a million tractors. And like, I had a car when I was in high school that had no power steering, no power brakes. It was like a go-kart, Ariel. It was a little four-speed Nissan Sentra. And the amount of like force and strength you had to use to like turn the wheel of the car, it seems like such a silly thing to say, but like, there is just a level of complexity happening here. The amount of like the computer wiring, the electrical in these ships, you have like so many mechanical elements to the plane, all of which need to be working right. Then you're going to add in anti-aircraft artillery. Like when they're talking about the flak, these are like, they're firing bombs into the air that then explode like Claymore mines, right? So that's with all these like peripheral blasts. And then you bring in like enemy fighter planes and it's like, holy cow, man. Like everything, like
these are grenades. These are like grenades in the air that are flying, or really just like a collection of bombs in a cluster that, if hit in the right place, will just explode. Like, it's not just the enemy fire itself, it's like what the enemy fire can do to their weapons and bombs on the plane.
Absolutely. Coupled with the fact that, like, just the plane itself, those huge wings filled with gas. I mean, you know, it's such a volatile situation that I think that they do an excellent job very quickly capturing the chaos, the panic, the fear, and like just how stacked against the odds these guys have it. You know, this is like fully uphill every time they get in that plane. Like, everything is working against them, you know.
Yeah, and to your point about like how heavy it is, I just remember the shot of like the two pilots trying so hard to like pull back on the plane, and how heavy, like you said, these like these huge vessels, it might as well be like a war sea ship in the air that they then have to like generate enough force themselves to like turn the thing itself. It's wild.
It's just incredible to me, man. You know, like I it's a thing I talk about a lot, Ariel. I'm sure you've heard me talk about it with you. The nature of, like, I feel like in the 21st century, we're so accustomed to the wonderment around us. We have like lost that sense of wonder. But when you really consider that we as like a species have built these incredible flying fortresses that are like as big as the largest animals in the earth and that can carry 10 men, 25,000 feet in the air. It's just such an incredible achievement. And then roll it back 100 years, right? Like, we did all this without computers. There's just such an investment of human ingenuity in all of this, mm-hmm. and so much pushing against them. And yeah, the mechanical elements of these guys literally fighting, wrestling with the yoke to drive these ships through the air at like hundreds of miles per hour under incredible duress. Like, they got it. I felt it, man. You know,
for sure. I love, and we'll get to like the people who are responsible for repairing and, you know, monitoring the status of the planes in episode two. I love that they get their moment and their like importance, which I agree is vital, like equally as vital, if not more important to the people who are actually flying the plane. But I love the moment in episode one where the planes return and Buck is like touching the plane and you just see it's shredded. And like, I was struck by this idea that like these planes aren't just their transport and in some ways their protection, but like these are extensions of themselves in the air, and that he would like be feeling it and connecting to it and almost like mourning the damage that the plane has was like really, really compelling to me.
Yeah, this is the point that Austin Butler, I was like, okay, I'm with you, dude. You know, he's got the Captain America look. I'm thinking of the Shannara Chronicles. I'm imagining him with elf ears up underneath that hat, you know. But then he sits with that plane and the weight of it. And to your point, I mean, this was, I talked about it a bit in our preview pod, the nature of so many like fighting pilot, these kind of things. Like, it's man and machine. I'm thinking of Tom Hardy and Dunkirk, you know. There's like that extension of like the plane being a part of you. Again, like my uncle the pilot talked to me about it a lot, the experience of like moving through the air that way with these titanic kind of vessels, and the way that Butler takes in the weight of it and the impact of it. And again, to the achievement of building these things, these are finite resources, man. These are just so precious. The amount of like, not just the financial investment, but the amount of physical work that's going to go into every single one of building these actual things. Then you got to fly them across the Atlantic Ocean and get them to England, right? Yeah. And then like, once they're over there, they're getting blown to hell. We're trying to repair them. Like, one of my closest friends in all the world, Ariel, is an aircraft mechanic. And I've just spent 20 years listening to him talk about it. It's such like an unsung profession. You know, you watch like the pilots walk through an airport in their uniforms and they get acknowledged, certainly in like a post September 11th era, like a pilot has clout and class and weight and status, and the mechanics don't. So I love that that honed in for you too. But Buck like reeling to the damage of the plane hit me. It was very effective.
Yeah, it really was good. We get this really cool set of interactions between Bucky and Buck involving what I believe is a $2 bill that Bucky gives to Buck for luck. And we'll know later on in the episode that like it, you know, Buck is so struck by his first experience being, you know, in war, basically, right? Being shot at and taking that damage and like seeing people that he knows die in front of his eyes, basically in the air. And he's like, this is, you know, something that especially is touched on in both Band of Brothers and the Pacific. Like, how do you prepare for that? And Buck says to Bucky, like, why didn't you tell me? And he's like, what do you mean? Tell you what? Like, tell me what it was going to be like. And, you know, Bucky with the what has become like the age old line in this universe in a way, like, I didn't know what to tell you. I didn't know what to explain. And I like the idea that like that was the best he could do, like take this for luck, because obviously, you know, Bucky cares for Buck and he doesn't want anything to happen to him. But it's almost like him prepping him for the fact that he will need a certain amount of luck to get through this.
Yeah, it was incredibly effective, right? Because you see Bucky go up first and then he comes back and he's talking to like his supervisor. They have that same similar beat of like, you've been up. Like, what do we tell the new guys? And he's like, you don't. You just, they gotta go see it, you know, the weight of it. And Bucky as the more fun-loving, effervescent, like, you know, running his mouth, blabber mouth, he's full of malarkey, you know, the way that like it impacted him, and he's trying, you could feel how intentionally casual he's trying to be before Buck is going to go on that mission. And then to the mission itself, Ariel, the chaos of it all, you know, like I touch on it, we'll get to it later, like the RAF guys, the difference between the British strategy of bombing in, at night versus bombing during the day. And they make this bombing run and have to, like, they're forced to pull back and they have to literally drop the bombs into the English Channel because they can't land with them. They might blow the whole plane up. Again, right. To your point, that whole catastrophic loss of life is for nothing. Like, they don't mention Lieutenant Dyke, Ariel, but right. like, he's there in spirit, right? There is this element of like, oh, another CO. Like, they're right. not, we're not digging into it with the same kind of depth, but they're like, yet another CO. And the CO, like, gets off the plane and dies, vomiting of his bleeding ulcer immediately. And it's just like, oh my God, dude. Whoa. Again, like, the banality of, like, the bureaucratic elements here. The fact that you have this entire bomber, like, battalion flying out, these three separate wings, they're losing planes left and right. They got, like, 40, 50 men dead in the air. And then the one commanding officer is like, I'm not doing this in the fog. Turn it all around. Like, oh my God, right? Yeah. The weight of that to come back. Like, you know, it's a thing that gets talked about Vietnam a lot of, like, what did we do this for? And it's not a thing that gets directed back to World War II because, like we talked about in the preview, you can look to World War II as a justifiable war, right? In retrospect, it's really easy for us to look at it as like, no, this was the right thing to do. And we were on the right side of history. But the reality of these men in the moment, there were a lot of, like, ignominious deaths that meant nothing but, like, pain and loss because of bad decision making. Yeah. And that's part of what it's about. And I'm really glad that they incorporated it that early on. Right.
Yeah. Right. There's an element to those particular deaths that you're talking about that just, like, feel so senseless and unnecessary. But, like, on the other hand, on the less emotional side of the spectrum, unfortunately, it is in some ways like a trial and error thing. You don't know how these things are going to go until you get up there. You can only plan so much. And, like, the idea, you know, another thing, you kind of mentioned this already, but the idea that the cold air is also an enemy up there, like, once, you know, there's damage in the hull of the plane, is crazy. Like, it's another thing that you have to keep track of. Like, now the elements themselves are against you. It's harrowing for sure.
It's literally just like everything is against them, right? I mean, that's what you feel, to the extent that, like, oh, the landing gear is broken. We might all die. We have made it through this, like, absolute chaos, but like, one wheel won't drop on this plane full of bombs. Mm-hmm. Hold on to your seats, boys, you know, cross your fingers. Like, everything is against them up there. You're just in such an alien atmosphere, right? We are literally not meant to be there. And we have forced ourselves into this environment to control it and utilize it. And to your point of trial and error, I think that Buck has this great line where he's like, we just had to pretend we were ready. Like, after training in the States, we got out there and we had to, like, wake up and pretend that we were ready for what was coming. And not one of us could actually know until you are in it. There's no sense of what you're coming up against. And in one sense, we could look at the CO not dropping the bombs and be like, that's the responsible decision, right? You don't drop bombs on what might be a civilian town.
Right. And the way he so forcefully and emphatically makes that point, like, I'm not dropping these bombs just, you know, willy-nilly without knowing where we're dropping them. I literally can't even see the ground. It's a personal decision, but one that, like, rings true for us, I think.
It does. It resonates. You can only indict him so much. I, like, invoke Dyke, but he's not really that bad, right? It's not like, it's not incompetence of leadership. It is just this executive call that's impossible to understand. And you know what really got me, Ariel, is as they land and then they're all getting rounded up for this interrogation. Like, the way that this has given such kind of clarity to me, just in two episodes of some of the elements about, like, pilots and the kind of iconography, even just the coats, the bomber coats, right? There's such, like, a clarity to, like, oh, right, these guys could be, like, freezing to death up there 25,000 feet in the air. Like, they need wool, you know? All of them getting pulled back in for the interrogation after the fact.
No talking to each other. You have to report in first. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, it really, like, struck me, the intensity and the the forethought to really try to extract some accurate records from the chaos of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got 300 men. That's 300 different stories that you're going to get about what happened up there with variation, and have to like parse through all of that to the trial and error that you're speaking of to figure out how to do it better next time. Right. They're like learning on the fly, and the cost is human lives and like these planes, which are the umbilical cord to like keep them alive in the air. You know, there's just, it really worked, the whole kind of formula of it all. Like, it was conveyed pretty effectively just through this first sequence, you know.
For sure, for sure. Staying on the bureaucracy point, we see Egan Bucky get promoted to air executive. Spoiler alert, it won't last. But he's disappointed because it means, and we saw this a little bit with Winters and Band of Brothers, like you reach a certain point and you're kind of now disconnected from the actual battle. And there is a disappointment that he feels not being, you know, on the plane with his brothers and trying to like make a difference.
I loved it. I love that, like, you know, Buck is giving it to him before he leaves. He's like, I'm shipping out early. And Buck's like, buddy, you're not flying. You know, like, you're the executive officer. You got to deal with things. And it's such a reversal of what we get in Band of Brothers, right? We're all like the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, like, do the thing of like, no, no, no. If Winters is out, we're out, man. Like,
right.
We need Winters, you know? They're like all trying to like step down. But the idea that like the promotions are important, and like this guy just wants to get demoted and get back in so badly, you know? He can't like accept it. And he's acting out like so kind of like chaotically, the breaking of the narwhal kind of
tossing. I was just going to mention that. I'm so glad you brought it up because I think it's so telling for him as far as like his personality, like these really important moments of setting up who these people are outside of just the war.
Yeah, I think to the fictionalization and the dramatization in the adaptation of this story, this feels like one of these things that we turn the volume up on. Like, we basically gave him a Back to the Future 2 Marty McFly, right? Of like, don't call him chicken. But it's like, if Bucky starts singing, look out, boys. Like, we can't let him start singing. You know what I mean? And it's such like a very clear, like, if then, and there's a couple of points even in these first few episodes that Buck's got to like, no singing, you know, we got to bring him in before we get there. And you could feel the energy there, you know, like Bucky's going to sing at some point, shit's going to go sideways, Ariel, you know? But,
it's giving like Kristen Wiig on SNL doing Liza Minnelli saying, don't make me sing, don't make me sing, but all you have to do is sing.
Yeah, it's really good. And I love that he's like, I'm not even a good singer, you know?
And I appreciated that not to like read too much into, because I think ultimately it doesn't matter, but like the singing wasn't that great. Like, it was perfectly passable, but like most importantly, just like human and felt real of like what would have happened. Like, maybe he is actually a good singer in the right circumstances, but he's not really in a state currently in his blood alcohol content seemingly to be, you know, a good singer. I thought it was a really funny moment.
I agree. I just, you know, it's maybe like, it's a little bit like TV-ified, right? To be that on the nose. But at the same time, it's like really great characterization, I think, to like distinguish these two guys who share a name and their personalities. I think you feel the energy between them and the tension and the kind of sense of responsibility that Buck has over Bucky in the same way that like Winters does with Nixon, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you feel that camaraderie and the friendship between them. And I love just how dedicated he is to like getting back in the plane, especially after having flown two combat missions, right? Like, there's a world where so many of us could imagine like everybody wants that executive job, that they don't have to get in the plane ever again. Right. And he's just desperate to go up there with this man. I mean, it's survivor's guilt, right? That's part of like what we're talking about. It's not exactly that, because it's kind of like pre-survivor's guilt, but like, you know, it's that same Band of Brothers energy that Dick Winters was like so diehard about, and that Spielberg and Hanks were like missed on those first dailies that Winters told them, like, follow me, right? Yeah. This notion that the leaders were not going to send you they were going to lead you. And that's really important, I think, to the storytelling when you're doing something like this, when you're working on a project like this. And I think they carry it really well with Bucky, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And lastly, the one thing I want to call out, another really funny moment for me was one of these quote unquote Last Supper breakfasts that they get.
Oh God.
And then the guy spills the salt and they're like, okay, throw it over your right shoulder. And he chucks the whole thing.
Ariel, I gotta ask.
He laughed so much. It was so good and simple.
Was this ever a thing for you? Do you come from like a superstitious family?
No, you know, my first interaction with this was the Dumb and Dumber movie. Like this immediately put me back into that situation because it was not something that to answer your actual question, yes, there are superstitions in my family, but this is not one of them.
This is not something
that I had ever heard of, like outside of, you know, pop culture or whatever media. But it really just sent me back. It was such a quick moment, but one that like was really, really funny. And to your previous point, like, you know, the levity is obviously important to throw into the mix to kind of give us a break as the viewer who are watching all of this, and just get to see another, you know, human moment between these people.
I really love it. I come from a very superstitious family. There was a lot of knocking on wood, you know, but the salt thing was very much a thing in my family. Like from when I was 4 years old, I knew if I spilled the salt, I got to throw a pinch of salt over my shoulder. Okay. You're not supposed to throw the whole thing.
But theoretically, the more salt you throw over your shoulder, the better it is, right, to fight the superstition.
So what I love about it, it's like stupid, and this is me being like maybe too pretentious and elitist jerk, but like it is funny and it creates like a moment of levity before the tension of going up. But it also conveys something really important, I think, and simple, which is like, this is a simple guy, man. You give this guy an instruction, he's going to throw the salt. He throws the salt over the shoulder. Mm-hmm. This guy's about to get on a plane with one of these other men and have a very vital role on that plane, right? And I think like he embodies all of them, any of them, right? It is probably the better way to put it, that like these are simple dudes that are following instructions, and you got to be real specific about the kind of instructions you give, because it's possible while they were like great men who gave everything that they could possibly give, their lives in these planes to go fight for their country, they may not have all been like, you know, aeronautical engineers, right? They were not like learned. They were not all necessarily like the sharpest, brightest thinkers, right? And like, especially under the duress of the moment. And so I think it conveys like an implication. There's like a subtext of menace to that, to me, Ariel, of like, oh my God. And now you got to like rely on this guy, right? Yeah. To go do something. And like, I don't know. It struck me as being both very funny, but also like instructive to kind of who we're dealing with to a degree.
Right. No, for sure. It definitely isn't there just by accident. Okay. I think I'm ready to talk about episode 2. And we very quickly learn that Bucky got demoted. And then I wrote here in my notes, and also gets punched in the face, not in that order. But the punch in the face thing is so interesting to me because it's not, yes, it's played somewhat for comedy, but it's also like kind of sad. The idea that like he doesn't feel anything and he wants to feel something, and his only recourse is to ask Kurt to punch him in the face, who, you know, this is a commanding officer, or this is someone who's, you know, certainly in a higher rank than Kurt. And he's like, are you really ordering me to do this? Because like, I don't want to punch you in the face. What if you're telling me to do it? I'll do it.
It's really great, man. It's really great. You know, I mean, we see it with Bucky with like the drinking. He's clearly like self-medicating. And I think, again, you know, listen, I'm speaking about my personal experience. I don't mean to like paint with such broad strokes, but in a lot of ways, this is a generation of men, in my impression, that were raised like not to cry, not to weep. And then you're talking about soldiers. I mean, so much of what the training that we saw in Band of Brothers, these guys go to basic, they get trained, and it's to compartmentalize your emotional reaction in the moment, right? Like you have to be able to watch your friends get blown up in the plane and continue flying the plane so that the bombs get dropped. And the way that sometimes that's done really effectively, and we're not like capable of even like connecting, like the human mind is incredible in how it can like fracture off and silo away some of like the impact and the reactions to things, the way stress will like unfurl and react years later after an event, and you have these flashbacks. But I think that that Bucky does a good job conveying to me the angst that he knows he should be like wrecked about these deaths, but that it is like he's got this stone in his heart and he's shut down and he does want to just feel. And Barry Keoghan, like, I really love him. I'm from New York, Ariel. I don't know where exactly in New York he's supposed to be from with this accent. I thought it was almost maybe a little Chicago. I don't know if I sound crazy saying that, but like this accent is crazy, Ariel.
It's very, I would call it like very like nondescript. Like it's just kind of, he could be from just a general vague region, very, I don't know, Northeast, but like also including Chicago. I just think it's a good, like, he's doing a good accent. I guess I agree ultimately that I'm not sure it's a what would be considered like a traditional New York accent.
Yeah, I heard a point where I thought they said you're from New York, right? When he punches him.
Yeah, no, exactly.
New York, right?
That was almost my opening to you. Like, you're from New York. But
I love the vibe with them, you know? And I like Barry Keoghan as like just one of the pilots, right? And like, oh, friends in high places. Like episode 2, I thought, did a really great job like transitioning out of the initial shock of all of this to all of this men. And like, okay, this is going to be what it is now. We got to like figure out how we manage it, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. And we spoke a little bit about these really unfortunate, senseless deaths. And we get early on in this episode, just like a practice landing gone wrong and the plane just crashes into the ground and explodes. And you just assume that all of the people died on that plane, because how do you survive something like that? It's unfortunate. And to your point, like, they have to move on. Like, yes, it's sad and they take a moment and they're obviously, you know, getting stuff from the wreckage and getting the bodies and all that. But like, ultimately, it was just a practice run. Like, it wasn't even a quote unquote real war situation, even though they obviously are at war. It's extra, extra sad.
Yeah, I mean, back to like that episode 1, the landing in Norway, when they're like coming in and the wind and like just trying to land on the runway against the tailwinds. And again, when we think about the kind of like computer assistance that exists in your car to drive to the grocery store today, none of that stuff was in these planes, right? It's all like very basic, very mechanical. You got guys in the back puking on their maps with protractors. Do you even know what a protractor is? You know what I mean? Like, there's just such a removal from the reality. And the simple fact is, you got to train these men to fly these planes, right? And these planes are like incredibly expensive resources that involved like thousands upon thousands of hours of meticulous man hour to construct, to transport, to get here, the cost, the expense. And then you get to fill them up with 10 guys that like might make a mistake training and practicing and crash, and there is no like driver's ed instructor next to you that can like yank the wheel. It's just the reality of this kind of scenario that I think becomes like so easy for us to overlook, especially in the media that depicts this stuff, Ariel, right? Like, we so often will spend time in Dunkirk with these fighter pilots, but like not with the ground crew. You know, you don't see the dozens of men that died in practice runs. Like, I'm really glad that they're including these peripheral elements to paint the full picture. I mean, that's what I expect the show will do as we're deep diving this like 100th Airborne. But it conveyed just so much of the intensity. And again, to the characterization, they all come up and are like, who was it? One of the new pilots. And the only guy who knows his name is Buck, right? Yeah. Major Buck is like, it was so-and-so. And we're carrying again that winter's energy forward. This guy is like got all the traits of like that noble, stoic, gentle leader that like you can be inspired by, you know, in like really dramatic ways.
Yeah. This guy, the, you know, seemingly this person who who perished in the crash was like a, you know, one of the replacements, to use, you know, a term that we learned in Band of Brothers. And like, there is a little bit sometimes, unfortunately, some disconnect between, you know, it's almost like protecting yourself, right? Like, to the point about Bucky, like, protecting himself, whether he knows it or not, to like not feel the enormity of like all this horribleness. This is, there's a way in which, you know, they're protecting themselves by trying to keep some of these newer people distant, because it's like, oh God, no, not another person that I have to like invest emotionally in and might die, like that I have to mourn. There's like a level of just very human protection there.
Yeah, I mean, especially for the higher ups, right? These are all like the officers coming to like the after of a fact, and like, you know, the, I don't know, we'll track it forward, but this is a group during World War II that took like notoriously catastrophic casualties in the same way that Easy Company and Band of Brothers gets like sent through the meat grinder through Bastogne and Foy and all that. They come out the other side with like an incredible attrition rate. These guys are known as like the Bloody Battalion, you know, they lose a lot by the end. And I think that like we're setting up that well, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And here is where we meet Ken Lemons, who's played by Rafferty Law, who is all of 19 and is one of these people who, one of these crew chiefs who is responsible for taking care of the planes and repairing them. And I love that the show, you know, says it in very explicit terms. They don't get any medals, but they are obviously a vital part of the machine, and they take care of the plane literally while the men sleep. Like, the idea that like in a way there is a 24-hour operation, and at night the planes are being repaired while the men are sleep, while the pilots are sleeping and, you know, being taken out of commission, whatever. And these people are, while they may not be the people who are getting the awards, like they said, they are just as important, if not more important, than the pilots.
Yeah, it's really, again, like I have a bunch of people in my life that work in aviation, you know, and one of my closest friends has been a mechanic in the professional aviation business for 20 plus years, since pre-9/11. And so I've gotten like a lot of like kind of anecdotes about it. But my word, I mean, especially the timing is on point, as we've been talking about planes a lot in the news these days, and the fact that there's only like two major aircraft manufacturers domestically, and most of your planes are being made by these folks and loose bolts. Like, these guys have really thankless and impossible jobs, even just in domestic, like commercial transport. But now to put it into this military context, like, I appreciate this so, so, so deeply. And the fact that we have that explicit, like, to the pilots, these men were heroes, right? Like, these guys who are putting the planes back together, like, you rely so profoundly on everything that they do, these electrical systems, the mechanical systems, the fuel systems. I mean, again, like, I don't mean to beat the horse, but there's just so much complexity to one of these vehicles, and then like put it under anti-aircraft fire and send some like German freaking fighter pilots after you, and like, my word, man, but you rely on these folks to keep you alive, right? It's a matter of trust. It's a thing I think about all the time, Ariel. I'm walking up like an old staircase on a hiking trail in the woods, and I'm like, who put this together?
Yeah,
like, are all the screws in here? Like, who did this? And like, there was just a measure of like, we, you know, we've romanticized the past because that's what we do as people. But when we talk about things weren't made like they were in the old days, you know, there's a thing that my grandfather said all the time to me in the 80s, and like, he was thinking of those guys in the military who like kept his plane together when he had to fly across the Atlantic, and the mechanics on the ships sailing back and forth across the ocean. And like, you know, you couldn't F up, right? Like, to that degree, these mechanics, like, you don't loosen a bolt, you miss a valve on the fuel intake, 10 guys are going to die up in the air, and that's going to weigh on you, you know? So I love that they included this, like, it takes a village to fly a fortress, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the guy who was piloting the plane that went down, it was like, oh, he just turned, you know, it seems like either he turned too early or too quickly or too slowly. Like, again, the very small margins of like a human being making a decision in real time that ultimately, you know, goes wrong. And it's unfortunate. And obviously, these people are really, really important. And, you know, I think you learn something about Lemons, especially in the way that he interacts with those children, the local children. And, you know, there's the little kid with the, you know, prosthetic arm, or, you know, or just really a hand, I guess. You don't really see the rest of his sleeve, but, you know, the idea that like he would be extra kind to this kid who probably gets made fun of a lot and is probably a little bit of an outcast because of this war. I mean, we don't know for sure, and it ultimately doesn't matter, but like the local cost of like they are visitors in this country, and he is like paying a kindness to the locals in this way.
I loved it because I thought it spoke to Lemon and like the 19-year-old of it all. Like, this kid's he's not that much older than this kid, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, like, he's still a teenager.
Yeah, that's like part of what I connected with. Of like, you can imagine the younger siblings, that element of him like being a kid and being excited about the fire. And I definitely got the impression that the prosthetic was related to the combat. I mean, it's part of what the RAF are talking about and why the British had such a different strategy when it came to the bombing. But the Blitz was happening for years. The British had been in war with Germany for 4 years at this point, right?
Yeah.
And the Blitz was like the Germans flying over the English Channel and just bombing the shit out of everything that they can hit, right? Night after night after night. We see the beginning of it at the end of like episode 2 of the Americans, like, oh, somebody's getting schlacked, might be us next, you know. So I think like it's conveying some of that in with the unspoken details in the background. But I'm really with you. I thought Lemon is like excellent, and I'm so glad that they incorporated this element of the characters. Would have been really easy to just focus in on the hotshot flyboys and like it in the excitement of the plane, but like setting fire to an oil slick was like a real emotional high of the episode for me. That's impressive, you know.
That made those kids' days for sure.
Yeah.
And to the, you know, you mentioned the Royal Air Force. We can get into what I call the American Air Force, Royal Air Force friction. And, you know, there is a, as we've already said, like the differing philosophies of like bombing at night versus bombing during the day, and how, you know, bombing during the day is like inherently suicide is the way that the British Air Force guy refers to it as. And they get into some, you know, some heated debates about whether there should be an S at the end of math, and you know, just the ways in which their cultures are different. You know, they speak the same language, but in some ways not really. And you know, it ends in a, the interaction ends in a very entertaining fight between Kurt and this guy who, this British guy who's kind of a, he's a douche.
Yeah, he's a douche. He's an Air Force douche.
Unnecessarily cavalier about some of these things, and like, oh, you Americans don't know anything. Like you said, they've been at war for so many years. It's almost like old hat for them, and they, you know, they've been through so much more, and they feel like almost like an owner. It's their country, right? They feel like an ownership almost of the of this part of the war. And he gets punched in the face for what
I love the scene. Yeah. I thought it was just really great. The way that like you're conveying again, the like, uh-oh, Bucky might start singing and Buck's going to rein him in and like do the diplomacy thing. Like you feel the tension rise and subside as it's getting like managed a little bit. And it is inherently creates this friction in me because there's the part of me that's like, why are you guys fighting? You know what I mean? Like, you guys got to get along, man. We're all on the same side. But then it's got that like hazing element, that like fraternity hazing thing of, to your point, the Brits are like, do you have any idea how many people have died? How many people we've lost? How many planes we've lost in the last 4 years? Like, ungots on you, Americans, you dumbasses, stop flying in daylight. Like, there's just, it felt very real in a lot of ways. And then the Baron Keoghan, I'm like, please let me have this one. I'll owe you one. I'll owe you one.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, I love this kid. The two hits, him hitting the British guy hitting the floor. If we call it a fight, I guess, but like he just dekes him and lays him out, Ariel. I'm like, all right. Yeah. I see you, Barry.
He's definitely a really good ducker, Kurt, Barry Keoghan, because he and I just rewatched, as I do every January, the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah,
it really struck me this past viewing time that like so many of these characters are primed, even the ones that have no battle experience, are primed to just duck at the right moment to avoid getting hit by
basic instincts,
like a fist or, you know, some flying mace of some kind. he's great. He's ready. And I was really worried, to be honest, because like you said, he has now become the chosen champion of this battle, even though he wasn't really like the one to kind of be called out. But he's like, please let me do this. I know I can do it. And I was like, oh no, is he going to do it? And he does it. He does it great.
It was so good, dude, because there was the element of like, oh man, these Americans are pretty drunk, actually. Mm-hmm. Like they might be about to get their asses kicked. and you know, that's probably not what's going to happen. But I just think it was like just kind of how anticlimactic it was, that it's mm-hmm. not like a big kerfluffle in the streets or like fisticuffs. You know, Barry just lays them out. And I'm like, all right, cool. Yeah. Cool. I'm here for it. You know,
that's that. Go back.
But then like the revisiting of it later, too. Right. The fact that like they're like, oh man, they were right. Like mm-hmm. they were right. This is suicide. Yeah. And Bucky's like, what are we going to do? And Buck says, we're going to lead them through. You know, yeah. This idea that like we know these orders are FUBAR. We're yeah. going to follow them because we follow orders, and we're going to try to keep everybody behind us alive. We're going to do the best we can in this untenable circumstance. I mean, that's war, right? Like yeah. there's nothing that's going to be easy. There's like the best route and then the route that you got to take. And at the end of the day, like you can debate whether it was right or not, or should they have bombed at night, like the ethics, the morality of it all, but this was their job. And quite simply put, like they just had to do it. Right. And mm-hmm. so that leadership element of like, we're going to lead them through. Like, I really liked it the way it sets up like a fun, dramatic scene that mm-hmm. then has a bit of resonance that carries throughout, you know?
Absolutely. Cause I think this conversation about, you know, having to make decisions in real time that like you are not prepared for in training in any way, because there's only so much training you can receive. It segues very nicely with to Crosby, you know, having to be the substitute, you know, speaking of this, like substitute in the battle, in the friction between the two air forces, Crosby has to come in and be the navigator now on this plane, even though he wasn't going to be, because the other guy's really sick. And it's Bubbles, I think, right? Who's sick. And so Cross has to take over. And I love the way he's running into the plane and he's already like, oh God, oh God, oh God. Like he's so nervous. And you're just thinking the whole time, like, please, please don't vomit. But he has to do, he has to make these really, he is under the intense duress that everybody else is in of like, okay, we are in an active war zone, but now like my body is betraying me, but I have to focus and look at this map and triangulate where we are, look out the window, figure out where we actually are. He kind of like didn't do so great in the first episode. And I think in this second episode, he really gets his moment of redemption of like under this duress. He does, to his credit, he's like, give me a second. I need a minute to like look at this map and figure it out. And he saves all these people. He saves the you know, Kurt's plane that had been hit by identifying the right place and identifying where they could go. He thinks on the fly. The microphone isn't working in the plane, so he has to run up to the pilots to convey the information to them. This is Kroz's like highlight reel, as far as I'm concerned.
It's friggin' incredible. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was like really, really great the way that we manage it, because it's not only all those elements you're talking about of like the pressure and the moment of being under the gun, but like he's in the first plane. He is there with the most important guy, right? Mm-hmm. He is in the point plane that everyone is following. We see the beat where like he's like, I need a minute, I need a minute. And we start moving back through mm-hmm. all the other planes behind these guys. We're like, what are they doing, dude?
Right,
he's got to turn. Why are we not turning? You know? And we take it for granted watching our stupid Marvel movies that everybody's got an earpiece and we all can just talk to each other. And it's like, no problem. You can imagine 40 effing planes with the radio frequencies going back and forth and the chatter and like German radio interception. Like there's so much intensity there. I mean, like all of us have like gone and gotten a new job. You ever have that day where like the boss comes and stands over your shoulder, the owner of the company, your direct supervisor, your supervisor's supervisor, and you're like sweating through your shirt and mm-hmm. and about ready to like have faint because of like the pressure. Like this is just incredible to take this guy who like he is the reason that first plane crashed, that loses the landing gear or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. They get lost. He steers them into France. They fly into German artillery and then they crash a plane and almost kill everybody on a simple, like, we just need to get to the Air Force base. That wasn't even a mission. Right. So the fact that like he screwed the pooch that badly and now is like, okay, dude, you're going to go in the boss's plane and take pole position. You're flying point.
Yeah.
it felt crazy to me in one sense. Like, you would imagine, like, well, why wouldn't they pull him and put one of the more senior navigators in the forward plane? Right. But like, this is all time sensitive shit, man. Yeah. There's not like, and again, like, there's orders and the bureaucracy and like the pegs go in the holes that they're assigned in the military, right? We're not necessarily like adaptable until we're in the thick of it. You gotta like do what you're told to do. So I just thought it was incredibly effective. And then you layer in the like frozen puke in the helmet and like the grossness of it and the humor of it amidst the absolute carnage that's like happening up there. Like,
I'm hit.
It's really good, dude. It's a really good scene, you know? And like, it helps also maybe clarify like why you had to learn trigonometry in high school. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. At one point in time, this kind of stuff was very, very important, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I really was struck by, especially in this part, like, the very hyper compartmentalization of all the different roles. The pilots cannot be responsible for anything else but flying the plane, but they have to be told where to go. And the navigator's sole job is to figure that out. And like, it's just, it's so, it speaks again to, like you said, the importance of the navigator, of Kroz's role, of like him being able to focus and not when there was like the regurgitation on the map, I'm like, oh no, is this gonna make the map dirty? And then he's not gonna be able to read the map.
I was worried. Yeah, I was too. I'm like, my God, man, don't mess your map up. But I'm with you. I think that element of it was something I had some trepidation about in our preview pod, where I'm like, gosh, I don't know, you know, like how they're going to do the ensemble energy with these aircraft. But by going into the flying fortresses here, you have these crews on every ship. And like the way that the pilot hands the ship over to the bombardier, they just go into autopilot when they're coming into like bombing zones, right? And now the bombardier's got like full control. The pilot, it can't grab the wheel. He could theoretically, but like can't steer out of the way of the flak or like avoid the incoming, you know, fighters or whatever. It just, the specialization of the roles across these crews. It's really interesting. It's very, very insightful. And I'm kind of eager to learn about like some of the specificity of those jobs, right? But every one of these things having like multiple gunners. I mean, there's 12 machine guns on each one of these things. The ball turrets, like you always see that thing on the Millennium Falcon and like, oh, that's so cool. But like, yeah, like Lucas has taken that stuff right out of that B-17, man. Like, this is the World War II version of the Millennium Falcon, right? And that's really interesting to me in a lot of ways.
This is so funny. I'm smiling like an idiot because I was just about to mention Star Wars, and clearly I can never help myself but to go into like sci-fi fantasy. But the very like lo-fi radio transmissions and like, you know, conversations that they're having, I just heard, and you know, you have the guys, you know, piloting the guns, the bombardiers, and like, you know, handling the more like aircraft to aircraft specific you know, weapons. Of like, I could just hear Luke Skywalker's voice in my head, hang on back there. Like, it's just so, it just reminded me again, the transmission, the very like lo-fi nature of, I couldn't help but think of that.
Lucas was obsessed with this era. You know what I mean? He like loved his hot rod cars and fighter pilots, man. You know, like he grew up out there in California near military bases. He would see them like training in the air and the Mustangs up there. And like, he loved this stuff, you know, and like, it's so right there, especially when you go back to the original trilogy and they're all the headsets on. Han's got a little headset, you know. It's like, it's really great. Luke and the tail gun, like, it's exactly this, you know. And when you just think of how vulnerable it is, again, like, they're sitting in a bubble of glass, man, and you're like watching these other like planes come by at 500 miles an hour ripping off gunfire at you, you know. The gun jams, he grabs hold of it. Like in the Pacific, we see them get burned because they're putting so much ammunition out, and like the things are so hot. And here we see the other side where his hands literally freeze to the metal, you know. It's like, again, like every single thing of this environment is working against these guys and what they have to do. And then you throw enemies at them in this space, and like, it's a really high stress environment. They did a great job conveying it across the ship.
No, for sure. And I think being in that, like gunner's globe, you know, we do get the very adorable later on, or I actually, it has happened already where Bubbles gives Kroz his little snow globe.
Yep.
And like the idea when we see the guy in like the snow globe under the plane looking out, having like in some ways the best and scariest view of what's going on. And he has to get someone to help him get out of there. Like he is shut into this thing and he's like, get me out of here. Get me out of here. He's going to freeze to death. It's crazy.
Could you imagine the terror of being in that thing? And you're staring right at the ground. Like it's intense, you know, it's just an incredible amount of pressure. And like the reality of like, you're the only one that can really see what's coming at them from behind, right? The communication through the plane of like, what do you got back there, tail gunner? You know, really it's fascinating. The open sides of the plane. I mean, there's points where like they're getting hit by flak and a dude almost gets blown out of like just the gun hole on the side for like the side machine guns, you know? Yeah, it's great. It's really like you feel the movement inside of it. I think especially after two episodes, and it's so chaotic. It's really hard to track individual characters as we're moving between the planes other than our leads. I'll say that much, but like I'm beginning to feel like the cadence and the rhythm of each crew in their plane, you know?
For sure. For sure. And speaking of holes in the plane, I was really struck by the very simple, insane idea of like a handgun. Well, a flare gun really, but it's a handgun that is like inserted into a hole in the ceiling of the plane for them to send flares of different colors. I was like, wait, it's just like a gun that you stick in the plane?
It's just a flare gun attached to the top of it's the upper gun turret that he's in, right? He's in like the dome up on the top that rotates with the 50 cals, and he's just got the flare gun jammed out of the top, you know? And the whole thing of like, again, like, well, that they're in formation, those guys are like a total mess. We got to get them to like tighten up, you know? How do you do that? Those points where like they're in the clouds and like they come down in over the other thing. You have these planes like almost crash. Like again, I just keep saying it because it's so like strikes me, but everything is working against them up there. It's just such an alien environment, you know, and we're so accustomed to it, right? I mean, how many like domestic international flights are there every day? How many times a year do you get on a plane? You know, I know for a lot of people that's like the exception, not the rule, but there are people in our culture today in the 21st century that are like on and off a plane 4, 5, 6 times a day, right? And it's very easy to take for granted, like, oh boom, we're in Miami now, we're in California now, we're in Washington, right? Like, there's like a real practicality to like, no, you're flying through clouds. Like, you ever try to drive through a mountain on a foggy day? Like, it's scary, man. Yeah. It's scary to not be able to see what's in front of you.
And again, that's just another thing that you cannot train for. Like, you can train for like the proverbial cloud and what to do in the event, but you have no idea the formations of the clouds on a given day and how thick, you know, the fog is going to be, whatever up there. It's really crazy. The more details that you add to it. But thankfully, because of Crosby's incredible quick thinking and right decision making, and he makes a decision on the fly. He's like, we should go, you know, towards Scotland, essentially. And this is in the hopes of specifically trying to get the plane, Kurt's plane, who has taken damage, down to a safe place. And it's literally because of Kroz's quick thinking that Kurt's plane lands in Scotland. You know, they take out like what looks to be part of a farmhouse, and I was really scared, like, oh god, I hope nobody was in there. But ultimately it's a happy ending because they have a wonderful drinking moment later on in the episode where Kurt calls Buck and Bucky, and he wants to, you know, thank them for getting him home safe, and it's all because of Kroz.
It's really fantastic. The twofold elements of that, of like the entire battalion's like, no, we're going to fly with them. We got a wounded bird and we're going to stay with them. And we've already gotten the beat from Crosby of like, we're the only protection we have is together, right? It's like a pack of gazelle and like ultimately like the wolves coming after them. Like, you're just so outmaneuvered by the fighters that that one of these guys alone, like, yeah, you have 12 machine guns, but they can run circles around you and just like, and he's down to two engines, so he can't fly at speed. You're like this slow target.
He has to conserve fuel as well.
Yep. The fact that like all of them hang back and stay with him, and that Crosby is able to get the entire like group back to the base. It's a real moment, you know? And then we see it of like, okay, so who should we give the promotion to? You want a promotion? And he's like, no, you got to give it to Bubbles, man. And they're like, but dude, you kicked ass today. And he's like,
it was you.
I got very lucky. I puked in my helmet. Right.
Like, you know, please. I got what looked like beans onto the map. It was just all very unfortunate.
It was very rough, man. You know, so it just is great, and it hits those beats that I think you need. I think I really appreciated that they did the 2-episode start here, part one, part two, but the closure, it captures that band of brothers energy of like, these guys are in it together, right? They're not going to leave the wounded plane and like let it drop, especially after the casualties that they've seen just in one flight. You know, they lose whatever it is, 4 planes on that first run. And like, that's a lot. That's 50 men, you know?
Yeah. No, and for sure, I was really thinking this moment, especially of, you know, Crosby getting this like reluctant promotion that he has very clearly earned in the eyes of everyone else, and certainly in our eyes as viewers, you know, like the reluctant ruler, right? Like Jon Snow, I don't want it. You know, like these people make the best leaders. But it reminded me so vividly of Lipton in Band of Brothers, who like becomes this like emotional, you know, compass for the entire, you know, group that he's with, his band of brothers. And like, when he gets the promotion from Spears, I believe it was, and he's like, Spears is talking vaguely of this person who has done all these things, and Lipton has no idea that he's talking about him. I was reminded very lovingly of that.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's a great moment. I think it's very much evoking First Sergeant Cartwood Lipton.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I already mentioned their relationship. I love Crosby and Bubbles, and like, you know, Bubbles already gave him his little snow globe that brings him luck. And, you know, again, call out to like the Buck and Bucky relationship, you know, extending, or exchanging their, you know, good luck charms. And then Crosby tries to give it back to Bubbles, and Bubbles is like, no, you keep it. Like, clearly it's doing something good for you. And like, when Crosby goes to visit him in the, you know, in the infirmary, I love their like loving relationship. Like, there's an intimacy there. They get like, you know, physical with each other, in the sense of like, they're kind of like, you know, grab assing and then like help, you know, trying to make each other feel better. And it feels very, you know, familiar, but I, you know, in the sense of like family. And we also get the letter. So like, Crosby has gotten a letter from his wife, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's definitely his
and
wife.
And Bubbles asks if he is mentioned in the letter. So I couldn't help but think, like, are they brothers-in-law? It's possible they're just old friends. You know, obviously, you know, if they're super old friends, and then Crosby met his wife and they're all very close. But like, it was a very cute moment of like, did she mention me? And then he shows him the letter. He's like, not a word. And then he turns it around. And it's so cute. She wrote in like the margins, tell Bubbles I said hello.
I love it. If Buck and Bucky are like Winters and Nicks, I had shades here of like Sledge and Snafu between the relationship of these two, and like the later Sledge and Snafu.
Yeah. What they grow into.
Yeah. Where like Bubbles just seems a little bit more like effervescent and over the top. He's got like the more kind of the deeper Southern accent even. And then we have Crosby, who's like a little more grounded and neurotic and like, you know, the more like erudite of the pair of them. Mm-hmm. And I really felt that energy, a great relationship, you know, like, again, where I'm having like a bit of a challenge of like, God, who are the people that are not Austin Butler and Barry Keoghan? Like, what's the name of anybody not named Bucky? there is like Bubbles really distinguished himself for me. Right. And I'm like, okay, got it. Now we got another good pairing here. I'm tracking. Yes. Right.
Yeah. When you can latch onto, that's like the miracle of like these pairings and groupings across any show, really, but especially in these shows, of like, oh, okay, if you can emotionally get me to latch on a character to a different character, I am much more likely to be invested. And this is just like very, very wise on their part. I will say, just for me, it's not a competition, but for me, Crosby and Bubbles are like slightly pulling ahead so far of the Buck and Bucky relationship.
Yeah, Buck and Bucky are very serious, man. Yeah. I mean, they're really like business guys. And Crosby and Bubbles definitely a little bit more fun. You know, there's a little more like lightness there for sure.
For sure. And speaking of lightness, we get a wonderful little light moment of a bike race in the mess hall. And Buck and Bucky are only too happy to be a part of it and take their prime position as the majors that they are and pulling rank. And then, of course, they fall on their asses. And there's like, this was like the Air Force version of the Tour de France. Like, there's this horrible pile where everybody just falls.
It's hilarious. You know what it really made me think of is in Band of Brothers episode one in Curry He, the old man on the bicycle that gets like ambushed when they're doing the training exercises.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's just this British man riding down the road. He's like, well, you got me, chaps.
And it's so funny because he like turns, he tries to turn one way, then he tries to turn the other way. He's like, oh crap, I have nowhere to go.
I'm surrounded, you know. I did love the bicycle race. Again, like, what struck me about this, I think there's like some deeper like storytelling in it, is the absolute yo-yo that these guys are on. You know, we talked so much about how the Pacific is a little bit less romantic than Band of Brothers because the Pacific Theater was like grueling, you know. We're watching Lecky like sit there in the rain for 12 days until like he's incontinent and can't stop urinating on himself, and like that's just tragic, dude, you know. And then we watch these guys in Europe that are like stomping through like a very familiar kind of environment, you know. So I think that like coming to this, it really like it strikes you the kind of the weight of all of it as the bombing like starts coming in at the end. There is this familiar element, but they're like they're completely out of their like safe space, you know. And the fact that like these pilots go from like incredible psychotic stress of being up in the plane, they're dying left and right, it's like a nightmare, and then they land and they're eating pancakes and sausage and dancing with girls and having bicycle races. Like the men of Easy Company did not have that, right? They were like stationed, these infantry guys are on the ground, their boots on the ground in the field, they paratroop behind enemy lines. The Marines in the Pacific did not have that. They were stuck on these islands that like we watch as the Navy sails away and leaves them, right? Where these pilots, presumably, if they survive the mission, they land back at like the safe air quotes Air Force base, where they're going to be able to indulge and drink too much and dance and listen to music and chase girls and have bike races. And that kind of like yo-yo of emotionality, Ariel, like really struck me as something that's going to be like singular about the experience of these guys compared to the others, you know what I mean?
No, for sure. I think that's a good point. And like the how few and far in between moments like this were in those
for the other guys.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I think that like sometimes we hear those other guys like, oh, I should have been a pilot, I should have done this.
Right.
The reality is like it's not necessarily better, right?
No,
these guys are going into like these really compressed moments of like catastrophic death and loss. And then they have to like linger in it and like land and wait. And they're in that kind of early Band of Brothers mode of like they don't know what the next mission's gonna be, where it's going to go, like when they're going to get called, and they just have to wait with it. And that is its own kind of terrible stress, you know.
Hurry up and wait. And then, you know, lastly, this conversation that we already talked a little bit about between Bucky and Buck at the end of episode two, where Buck is basically like, yeah, I think those British Air Force guys are like absolutely right. This is a terrible way of doing things, of bombing in the daylight. But most important to me emotionally, and this like screamed of Winters and Nix when like Buck is talking about his dad and like how his dad used to gamble at anything, whether it was like dog fights or horse races, whatever it was, he always came up with an excuse or a way to be able to make a bet on something and seemingly always lost. Like Buck has all these like very tragic, to be clear, like upsetting memories of like waking up, you know, fallen asleep at a betting place or on a bench or just somewhere random because his father has gotten them into like seemingly a horrible situation once again. And just, you know, sharing parts of his life and the way Bucky comes back to him and is able to put it all together and be like, oh, so that's why you don't like sports. That makes a lot of sense.
does. And it's really interesting, the whole notion of Buck, of like this singular competition. He's into boxing. He'll jump on the bicycle and race everybody else, right? Like, he's all about these like individual distinguishments, right? But the things that his dad honed in on, you know, it's great. It just belies a suggestion that we're going to like learn more about these men the further we go, you know, and presumably understand a little bit more about where they came from, because we didn't like start with them before they got here, you know.
Right, exactly.
They are already both these majors and leaders in this organization. And like, where did they come from to get to this place? So I like the kind of suggestion of where it's going to take us.
For sure. For sure. And I really, hearing you talk about it has now made me think of another connection, like the similarities between Winters and Buck in this way, specifically of Buck. Like, I'm reminded, one of my favorite Winters lines from Band of Brothers, I believe it's the very first episode. And it's about, it involves gambling. And he's like, don't put yourself in a position where you can take anything from these men. Yep. And like, Buck has his own very personal historical reasons for basically feeling the same way. Like, he's never going to gamble full stop, but he's certainly not going to, you know, put himself in a position where he's gambling against other people, I think is really interesting.
No, it's on point. That Winters line really stays with me. And ironically, he's talking to Buck Compton, yet another Buck, right? Yeah. You don't need anybody named Buck in 2024, Ariel. Like, well, let's bring Buck back. Can you call me Buck?
We used to name people Buck in this country.
I know, right? We're really into animal names, Buck and Robin. There was a lot of stuff going on. But
I,
it's a great line, and it conveys that responsibility of leadership, you know, and you feel so much of that same energy. I was really taken. Austin Butler won me over in 2 hours, Ariel. I went from like, the elf ears were gone. By the time we got out of the end, I'm like, all right, I see you, Stone Cold Major Buck. Like, let's do this, dude. I'm ready to like fly with you. Lead me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have anything else. Anything else we should say about these two episodes? Anything we missed?
I don't think so. I'm really like taken by them so far, and I'm very excited to get into episode 3. I think that, like, you know, Band of Brothers is really hard to match. I think that for me, it stands on like the extraordinary tier of television. Mm-hmm. The Pacific is like right behind it, and like the exceptionally good. There's a whole tier of just adjectives.
Well, maybe we'll do a tier list one day. Yeah.
And I think that this like has the chops to be there. You know, I too like felt some of those CGI elements. I feel like I'm noting some of the like, don't let him sing, the like TV characterization. notes, but like there's nothing I don't think like egregious. I didn't feel any missteps. I felt really more emotionally connected to our main ensemble after 2 episodes than I did with the Pacific. I think it took me a while to like really care about the guys in the Pacific the way that I care about these guys already. So that's a really strong start, I think.
No, I agree. And I think had it just been the one episode, I would have been feeling a little bit precarious still. But I think after 2 episodes, I'm really starting to feel it. And the show is, you know, feeling like it's vibing, and the characters are vibing, and we're vibing with them. And now we're, most important of all, we're emotionally invested. And that's, you know, the what you need most of all in these shows. So like we said, this was a 2-episode initial drop. And then going forward, it'll be 1 episode per week, and it's 9 episodes total. So there are 7 episodes left, and we will be back with you every single week from here on out to recap those episodes. So I think that's it for us on this front. But in the meantime, Rich, what else do you have got going on?
You can go find me in the places. I'm over at that site that I still call Twitter at DM Philly. I'm on Twitch, twitch.tv/DM Philly. We are getting ready to return to some D&D in space. Dragonfly season 4 coming back. A bunch of your post-show recaps regulars hanging out with me playing D&D in space. There's a YouTube channel with all the VODs to the old seasons and a bunch of old tabletop role-playing stuff. But that's going on for now. I'm going to be talking about Halo with the great Corey B. pretty soon. Ooh, it's coming back around for its second season. Keep an eye out for that.
Yes, Master Chief himself going into a different kind of battle. I am also on Twitter at that other Ariel, covering movies with Grace, a Puerto Recaps Theater. You know, speaking of movies, I can't believe I made it this far without mentioning, like, my big worry with Austin Butler was more like the Elvis of it all and like what he was going to do with his accent. And you know, his accent was like a little bit distracting. And like, I want to say the first like 3 minutes of this, of episode one. And then I was like, okay, this is fine. He's doing like something passable.
But I've heard about the accent, and all the articles were out this week, Ariel, of Austin Butler hired a dialect coach to get rid of his Elvis accent before he started filming Masters of Air. Have you seen any of these?
Because I hadn't heard that particular detail, but I know that like that is hilarious. I know that he was seemingly, or I don't even think seemingly, I think it happened at an award show, like he still had the Elvis accent, like he was so method while he was filming seemingly, and then he just he couldn't turn it off, like he just kept going, and the idea that you had to hire someone to unlearn the accent is just full stop hilarious.
It's kind of hilarious. Like, I see you, Daniel Day Butler. Okay, I got you, bro.
Exactly. What else? I'm also covering 6 Feet Under, another upper echelon series that I love, with the great Dr. Amanda here on Pusher Recaps. We are in full season 2 swing now. And that's been really fun to revisit another, you know, early 2000s property that definitely takes you back. And besides that, I think that's everything from us. Like I said, we'll be back next week with episode 3 coverage. Until then, stay safe out there, everybody.